or two up from the dark side of the moon. But it hasn't always been that way. During the highland clearances of the last century, the great mass of the population was shunted off the land to make way for sheep. Most ended up either in the outposts of empire or in the slum tenements of industrial Glasgow. But could that sad exodus, which brought a highland rural population to a lowland urban environment, now be reversed? Could the descendants of highland Scots return to the crofts and glens of their ancestors?
We're now in the post-industrial era. I mean, the Industrial Revolution is over. And I'm afraid a lot of Glasgow seems to consist of unemployment people dumps, which is a shame for the human condition there. So there is certainly room in the Highlands. We only have 0.4% of the population of Britain. And the Highlands are not naturally empty. They've been deliberately depopulated. So there is an opportunity. It's how we realise that. Well, that's a big question.
A group of people who are trying to answer that question are the former road protesters of the so-called Pollock Free State, a permanent encampment on the outskirts of Glasgow. Having lost their battle to halt the M77 motorway, they're determined now to win a bigger battle, to find their own way out of urban deprivation.
We're trying to be part of the movement to get sort of rural repopulation together. There's a lot of unemployment. And they're throwing young people out of these schools without any trades, without any skills. They're dependent on the dole. And we've got to open up study centres to introduce people to ways of life which is more dependent on their creativity, more dependent on their ingenuity, you know?
So is the Pollock Free State here, this encampment, is this a model for some other little free states across Scotland?
I mean, the idea is good, you know, okay. The place looks perhaps a wee bit shabby, you know. We're waiting on the leaves coming back to brighten the place up and that, you know. But,
Colin MacLeod and the rest of the Free Staters want to build a radical rural alternative to what he calls the gyro culture. But in the meantime, they've built themselves a treehouse.
This is quite impressive, isn't it? Whose idea was it to build this? This is,
It's
got to be the most elaborate treehouse that I've ever been in.
Well, the stump house here. A lot of work can be done.
A regular visitor to Pollock Free State is Alistair McIntosh, the director of the Centre for Human Ecology at Edinburgh University. He believes urban Scots should be encouraged to rediscover their rural roots, and he's tired of the Highlands being treated as a theme park for the few, rather than a genuine, living, working environment for the many.
You have what you might call Scotlandshire. And that is a situation that has been constructed by the clearance during the 19th century primarily of 500,000 of our people off the land. Now that we're into a post-industrial era, we've now got these people cooped up in high-rise flats like you see all around here. And it ought not be the case that the only feasible choice for many of the one-fifth of our population, 1 million people living in poverty in Scotland, should be up a tower block in a place like Pollock or Nidri in Edinburgh.
But how do you give them that choice? For people who live on the housing schemes of Glasgow, how do you reintroduce them to the countryside?
We're carefully studying in the Centre for Human Ecology the work of Rural Resettlement Ireland, where this wonderful organisation has resettled hundreds of families wanting to be moved into rural areas which welcome them because these rural areas are becoming depopulated, they risk losing their schools, etc.
But isn't the impact of that, though, to suburbanise the wild areas? I mean, if you go to Donegal in Northern Ireland, where people have moved out there, there are bungalows all over the place that have come up. There's a rash of development. Wouldn't you be actually ruining the very thing that you claim to love so much, the Scottish countryside?
I think when you see a Scottish countryside that is full of open spaces, and when you look carefully, you see the ruins of where people lived before. When in your imagination you hear the cries of the children who are cleared from those areas, when in your imagination you hear the laughter of the children who once played amongst those streams and boulders, then you see that we human beings are as much part of nature as the foxes, as the eagle is, as the wildcat. There should at least be some places where people can go and resettle, gradually build their own houses, perhaps starting off in a caravan, freed of the kind of strict planning constraints which make it impossible to do your own self-build type things in much of Britain. You can use a bucket for the toilet. for a while you're going through that process.
Say you'd like to see community control of the land and an overturning of the patterns of land ownership that's prevalent in Scotland at the moment, but the landlords of Scotland, the lairds, if you like, absentee though they may be, insist that they have been the guardians of the Highlands, that they have preserved the Highlands intact.
Well, they've done so by clearing out 500,000 people. They've done so by destroying many aspects of our culture. They've done so by overgrazing with their deer and burning for their grouse and other blood sport activities in a way that has reduced Scotland to what Sir Frank Fraser Darling described as a wet desert.
A sizeable chunk of that wet desert, though an area its defenders, particularly among the hunting and shooting fraternity, would no doubt prefer to think of as an oasis, is the Athol Estate in Perthshire. There are no buckets for toilets at Blair Castle, a favourite spot for deer stalkers. Andrew Gordon is factor of the estate, and as far as he's concerned, the less human interference in the Highlands, the better.
We've got a fairly small country, haven't we? Depends if you're a deer stalker or if you're a hill walker. Deer are a very flighty, sensitive breed, and any human attention near them will move them. So if we have a client out here stalking on the hill who's paying for his sport, and a hill walker comes over onto the same bit of ground, or even within a mile or two upwind of that deer, they will move. Walkers on the high ground bring very little into the estate. In fact, nothing in money terms.
Should the Highlands be the preserve, then, of the rich and the privileged?
No, I didn't say that. No. Many people who go stalking are neither rich nor privileged. But it is a sport. It employs a lot of people.
It's not a working-class sport, is it?
Certainly.
You're not going to get many people from Glasgow coming out stalking.
Certainly we do. We get people from all walks of life who come here and stalk. And a day stalking is will cost in the region of £200 to £300. For stag stalking, hind stalking in the winter is a good deal less than that. A day's pheasant shooting will cost you much more.
So it's a bargain, then?
Oh, yeah. I think stalking is cheap, I think.
How do you respond to the criticism that all this land has really been... It's been stolen, really, from people who used to be here before. That there was a peasant economy in this area, and all of a sudden the lairds came along and said, you're not having any of this, we're clearing you off.
I don't think this happened actually around here very much. I think the north and west, the clearances were there, and I'm sure there were all sorts of hardships and wrongs committed at that time. I don't believe that were people to be reinstated in the manner that they lived before, they would survive very long in this day and age.
Would you like to see more involvement on the part of the community in the running of this estate?
I don't think that's practical to see the community being involved in the running of the estate. And this is a business. It's owned by individuals or trusts. It's like saying that people who live around Solihull should all have a say in the management of the Rover Car Company, or if that's where they're made, I think they're made in Solihull. You know, you can't. It's not practical.
There is this argument about the Highlands as to whether it should be a sort of wilderness refuge, where people even talk about reintroducing the wolf on the one hand. There are other people who say that, well, what we should be reintroducing is people. What's your view of those two arguments?
Well, if you introduce people, how are they going to earn a living? You can't have everybody living off the state. Scotland is a fragile land, and it can only produce so much. There are a group of crofters in the northwest of Scotland who have bought their crofts from the traditional landlord, and I suspect what will happen as time rolls on is that the stronger ones, if you want to call it that, will buy out the weaker ones, and we'll end up what we had before as an estate with one or two big crofts, and a lot of people will leave.
Just down the road from Blair Castle, ecologist Ron Greer lived in more modest Highland accommodation in the village of Blair Athol. Ron left Glasgow 20 years ago to pursue his biggest passions in life, fishing and forestry. He says the land of Scotland has been abused and misused for centuries, is still being abused and misused.
At the beginning of the 1990s, there were 9 million sheep in Scotland. Now, the sheep are not traditional animals in the Highlands, they're exotic animals from a foreign country. And we're subsidising the land degradation. I mean, we're paying people, whatever it is, £35, £40 a head to keep too many sheep. It's crazy.
So people are making money out of deer and grouse, aren't they? The great estates around here, that's how they survive.
Well, yes, you can actually heat your house by burning the furniture and the floorboards and the rafters, but eventually the system collapses. So that's the analogy I would make.
So if you were to scrap the great estates and scrap the deer with them, or scrap most of the deer with them, what would you put in its place?
Well, I don't think you should scrap the deer. I don't even think you should scrap the sheep. I don't even think you should scrap the grouse. We just have to manage them in a different way that's based on biological reality.
So what ends it?
Well, in the end, they're providing a way of life for people. In the end, it gets right back to what Sir Frank Fraser-Darling was saying. He wanted an ecological regeneration of the Highlands so that the culture and the economy could be rehabilitated. That was the aim. It wasn't to create some artificial man-made Yukon for the conservation self-appointed elite. It was to create a working, living environment for a revitalised Highland culture based on the true potential of that environment and not in some kind of tartan shortbread myth.
But it is the nearest we've got to wilderness, isn't it?
Well, I suppose if you come from the south, and I fell into this myth as well, if you come from a highland industrial area, you associate wild heather moors and barren mountains and open space with a wilderness, but it is not. It's the product of thousands of years of human interaction with that environment. And it's the same in southern Norway, and in eastern North America. I mean, I was in Maine last year, a state the size of Scotland, and in there there's 20,000 black bears, 40,000 moose, 200,000 deer running about. I mean, at the bottom of the garden there are beavers and black bears, so plus a modern, you know, industrial society, so it can be done. So you realise that the Highlands and Scotland are the odd one out. That's when you go abroad and you compare Scotland with other countries, you realise everybody's in step except our job.
Time was when Scotland not only had a more even spread of people, but a fair old spread of trees too. The ancient forest of Caledon clothed most of the Highlands. The odd fragment still exists in what is otherwise a largely treeless landscape. The RSPB owns 32,000 acres of native pine forest at Abernethy in the Cairngorms. Whether it should own it is for some people a moot point, but this is not the pine forest of the modern plantation with its row upon row of jam-packed stunted spruce trees, but a forest fit for an osprey, the great fishhawk of the woods. Stuart Benn of the RSPB.
If we stand here and look around, the trees are well spaced, they've got lovely canopies and branches going out, we've got this superb understory of heather and blaberry and the like, which is full of insects and is great news for all the birds that depend on it. And I absolutely defy anybody to take a walk in one of these forests and not feel that they're in a special place.
And if it disappears, we've lost it forever, haven't we?
Pretty much so. You cannot recreate anything like this in a short time. Some of the trees we're seeing around us are 200-300 years old. Now, in the life of the forest, that's just the blink of an eye. But in human terms, it's almost incomprehensible. So, yep, if we chop it down today, we will never see its like again. Of course, the RSPB only owns a very small percentage of Scotland, and I don't think anyone would wish it any other way.
It's fairly huge though, isn't it?
It feels large, you're right. We say it's the largest remaining tract of native pine wood that there is left in the whole of Scotland, but you could walk across it in just over an hour. Now, that's not very big if you compare it to some of the built-up areas that we have in Scotland or elsewhere in the United Kingdom.
But should anyone, even a benign organisation like yours, own large chunks of land like this in Scotland? Do you have a right to it?
I think we do. The way I see it is that what is needed in Scotland and what is needed elsewhere in the world, indeed, is the long-term ecological health of the area, and that has to be the good to the good of the fish in the rivers, the deer in the hill, the woodlands, and ultimately that is what the people who live and work and visit these areas depend upon.
But the RSPB has ruffled a few feathers in the Cairngorms with its opposition to a proposed funicular railway on Cairngorm itself. Critics say RSPB land policy is strictly for the birds and takes little account of local people. According to Rob Gibson, land spokesman for the Scottish Nationalists, it's a kind of middle-class suburban imperialism.
Well, the major land issues that we're standing in the midst of is the equivalent of Oxfam. It's RSPB, a kind of body based amongst people in the suburbs, spending their money on trying to act in a first aid fashion to try and deal with one aspect of what should be a massive native forest.
But do you have no quarrel with the way this forest is being run at the moment?
Well, we could hardly do that. But after all, the people who paid for it are not based here, don't live here. The money that supports the jobs on it come from elsewhere. It's exactly the same economy as the big estates in the Highlands because they made their money elsewhere and they subsidised their estates for shooting. In this case, it's subsidised for birds. And if at the moment it happens to be the case that the RSPB is doing a good job with regard to one small area, it isn't, as they say themselves, the solution for the whole country. We must put the land back into the hands of a resident population. The political structures at the moment we have are a quangle culture. It's left to bodies which aren't elected to decide far too much for us. And if we had a democratic control over the conservation structure, Scotland would be an entirely different place because people would really feel ownership for much of the environment around about them. They would feel they were doing something with it rather than being excluded from it.
The Isle of Skye may have a bridge rather than a bonny boat linking it to the mainland these days, but it remains a typical Hebridean community, a land of largely Gaelic speakers and crofters. The local choir practices in the village hall at Kyleakin. Many of the choristers are from crofting families. Crofting is seen by many as a means by which Scottish farming can go back to the future, a pattern of rural living which has proved its sustainability. A model for those like the Pollock Free Staters, who'd like to see more people get back to the land. By necessity as much as design, crofting is small-scale, non-intensive. Crofters generally have one foot on the land and several fingers in other pies, like fishing or tourism. Up the coast at Broadford, I got the chance to look around a modern croft and meet a 20th century crofter.
Well, here I am perched on top of a Bronze Age, or possibly Iron Age, cairn, chambered cairn overlooking Broadford Bay on the Isle of Skye, and with me is Angus McHattie. This is an area that obviously suffered from the clearances, and many crofters were booted off the land. Did your family suffer that?
Yes, our family were originally on a small island in Bracadale.
So this is a re-establishment of
course. Yes, I mean, who'd been relocated, there's another name for it nowadays, but who had been forced for one reason or other to move. The Gaelic name for this area is Achiachurn, Field of the Cairn. So there has been a long history of settlement here, but basically this community is less than 200 years old in its present form.
Crofting in the Highlands and Islands has had a checkered history, but now it's getting official encouragement. The RSPB has formed a partnership with the Scottish Crofters Union to encourage traditional crofting landscapes. And at a hotel in Broadford, crofters meet to discuss a Scottish office plan which would allow them to form a trust to buy their own land. Fraser MacLeod is the director of the Crofters Union.
Many crofters feel that they don't own land. It is not possible for anyone to own land, but in actual fact, land owns them. And if you're standing on the top of a hill in the Highlands and Islands in the middle of winter in a howling gale, you begin to understand why that view prevails. In agricultural terms in the UK, there's somewhere about 2% of the population with an involvement in land. In many crofting communities, you might have over 60%, and in some crofting communities, you'll have 100% of people who have got an active day-to-day involvement with the land. And if you do have that involvement, you understand that relationship much more closely. There is one simple example that can be given. And if you take the corncrake, is one of the most globally endangered species in the world. There are some that remain in the United Kingdom, and I believe that every single one of them is found in crofting areas.
As a child, we used to have many sleepless nights
caused by the Corn Craig. And that doesn't happen anymore. The actual amount of land in this township which is cultivated and the way it is cultivated has changed in 30 odd years. And that, combined with falling numbers, has meant that these birds don't spend the summer here. We get passing migrant birds in the spring, but they don't actually spend time here. And this is a problem which is happening all over the Highlands.
No matter how much encouragement the Scottish Office gives, crofting is unlikely to have much impact in Edinburgh. But Kevin Dunyan of Friends of the Earth says all Scots, urban and rural, have suffered from a lack of any say in how their environment's being shaped. He showed me a vantage point overlooking Auld Reekie.
You can see almost everything there is to see in Edinburgh. We can see right across the skyline of the city, Edinburgh Castle, St Giles Cathedral, and the eye follows down towards Arthur's Seat and Salisbury Crag, these fantastic outcrops in the city centre. In the foreground of that we have Craigmillar Estate, where some of the poorest housing in the city is situated. And then further around we have a great area of green belt. We should enjoy it while we can. It's destined to become covered in houses in the near future.
But we're standing in the grounds of a medieval castle perched on top of a hillside overlooking a really beautiful part of Scotland, a lovely area of green belt. Can anybody really think that what's needed here is another estate of 5,000 houses?
What we've got is a classic pattern. We built a bypass around the city, and that became the new defining line of the city. People think we can build out to that, and that's now what they're choosing to do. What then will happen, of course, is the developers will see these new homes as new markets. And unlike England, we don't yet have the planning guidance in place to stop out-of-town developments. And so we have to expect that there'll be more of a pull away from the city centre to more out-of-town shopping. Let's take something even as benign as a new hospital. Sounds great, who can complain about it? The existing city hospital is old, it's overcrowded, but it's right in the city centre. If they build this new hospital down here in the south of the city, we know from studies made in Holland that car traffic by patients, by visitors and by staff will increase 110%. It's one of the incredible ironies of, it's the old saying, you know, you see paradise, you put up a parking lot. That's what's actually happening here in Edinburgh, almost literally, in fact. Behind us is a fantastic green site, which is destined for a park and ride scheme. I mean, this is complete madness.
You admit, though, that the population of Edinburgh is expanding and that housing is necessary. So isn't the council, aren't the developers, aren't they duty-bound to start looking at an area like this?
We don't have any great problem with urban development. In fact, there's a sound environmental argument to say that relatively high density conurbations are good things for the environment. People can make better and more efficient use of services. It's easier for them to do their shopping communally and so on. So I don't have any great problem with that. What I have a problem with is what we're seeing in cities like Glasgow, where you've got a great donut effect, where the city centre is being emptied, left derelict, contaminated, vacant, and people shoved to the peripheries of the city without services, without often, very often, a sense of community or history in the area they're going to. I don't like that kind of social and environmental engineering. And what I fear is happening is that there's still in Scotland some kind of view that we can simply shift peoples about as if they are simply tenants or house buyers rather than a community. And I think in Scotland still we have a very strong sense of community which resists that kind of social engineering.
That kind of social engineering and that kind of community may be seen at loggerheads once again in the Easterhouse district of Glasgow. 2 years ago, Crofting the Earth reported on Cathy McCormack's campaign to get proper insulation and solar heating for 36 homes on the East Hall Estate in Easterhouse. A huge success story. Too huge, maybe. Now the area's gone a little upmarket. Plans, big plans, are in the pipeline, and not plans the locals have come up with or even been asked much about.
Easterhouse has become a very viable place to live, right? And it's been promoted as the gateway to Europe. And what they're trying to do is build five leafy suburbs, reduce the population from 70 to 35,000. As far as I'm concerned, what's happening is like the land clearance is all over again. And like, I mean, one of your tenants, she's lived here since the day the scheme was built, and she's horrified. I mean, she's in her 70s and she doesn't want to leave her home. She doesn't want to leave her community. But at the end of the day, money talks and it's obeyed. And the particular houses that he lives in, the private sector run it, to build private houses.
Could you imagine many Glasgow people, though, wanting to get back to the land, not being moved out, but actually of their own volition, deciding they want to up sticks and move, say, back to the Highlands?
I'm not really sure about that, because basically I think people have good roots, and I think their roots are very important to them, you know? I mean, for example, I mean, one of their survival tactics, right, I call the TAP survival culture. You know, that if you don't have any money, tap a pal. If you don't need the money for food, then I can always tap somebody's door and say, like, I saw maybe bread. If they've run out of potatoes, they can tap my door. So that kind of community is priceless. I don't feel that it's really, really penetrated the minds of the politicians or the planners. That a community can never be stabilised unless you actually listen to what the community actually want, and I don't think that they're listening.
Cathy McCormack, in the words of the old song, belongs to Glasgow. And maybe it's a sense of belonging, whether it's in the middle of Glasgow or the back of beyond, which matters most when it comes to shaping a proper working environment for people to live in. There are those in Scotland who'd like to see the Highlands reclaimed for humanity and have people decanted out of the cities. Others would prefer remote areas to stay remote, maybe as reserves for wildlife, not for people. A middle course seems more likely, but whatever path Scotland takes, environmentalist Andy Whiteman believes democracy is crucial. He's written a book entitled Who Owns Scotland? And that, he says, is still the big question to be answered.
The agenda today is about giving communities, allowing communities, not giving them, but allowing them a greater stake in the management of the natural resources around them. With people living in a place, cultures survive, and cultures are just as important to conserve in the human species as eagles and badgers and things. And I think often it's all very well to say that, you know, people are bad to the environment, and that was a tack that many environmental groups took in, say, North Africa in the 1960s. They set up large nature reserves, kicked the people out because they thought they were bad for it. And then they tried to manage it themselves and made a complete mess of it. And they suddenly realised that the people that lived there knew more about the environment than they did.
But if you were to bring back people to the Highlands, what guarantee would you have that they have the sensitivity to make sure that the Highlands are kept as not as you say, not as a wilderness area, but as an area to be treasured?
What I would ask is, well, at the moment, 600 people own the Highlands. Now, what kind of sensitivities do they have? We don't even know who they are. Don't even live in the area. Their sole interest is coming in and fishing and shooting. Now, that's fine. I'm all for those 600 people coming in fishing and shooting. What I'm not for is that those people should, in turn, to secure that interest, own the whole place. And I don't think that if we move from a situation of 600 people owning the Highlands to 600,000 people owning the Highlands, that the environment would be in any worse state than it is just now. Local people have become alienated, not because they don't care about the environment, but because they're being treated, basically, as second-class citizens to geese and plants. And no one's going to stand for that.
Costing the Earth was presented by Mark Whittaker and produced at Pebble Mill by Mary Helly. And now the weather's gone.